So we move now to Isaiah chapter 58, and we'll come to the conclusion of the Isaiah scroll. Blenkinsop, who I've quoted a few times in my talks with you, who writes very well and writes very well on Isaiah, writes, "The indications are that beginning in the Neo-Babylonian period," that's the period of the Babylonian exile, that Babylonian period, "the approved kind of prophecy was becoming increasingly an activity of taking over, editing, commenting on, and updating existing prophecies. Prophecy became, in other words, more scribal and exegetical, more a matter of inspired appropriation and interpretation of existing prophetic words deemed to be still authoritative and valid than a matter of direct prophetic inspiration." It's a more scholarly thing that's happening after the exile. Brackets, I've explained to you also earlier, prophecy was one of those, with all its complexity, I don't want to simplify it, was something that happened within Israel and within Judah when the king of Israel and Judah was a Yahwist, was someone who should have been following the religion of Yahweh. And so they were able to directly confront him. And out of their prayer, they were able to say, look, you're not living justly. You're not doing what the Torah says. You're not doing what Moses was on about. You're living like Pharaoh. You're living like, you know, whatever they're saying. Or you're just, all that stuff we've already done. That's what they were saying. Well, that stops now because they've got no one to talk to. They just take the old respected books, as we might take a New Testament book, or whatever, and they take that ancient material and they kind of think, well, this was respected, this was real, this was, when the kings were here, we said this was what God was saying through the prophets, to use that term that needs hermeneutical clarification, but that's what they say. But now, what's it mean to us? What's it mean to us? So they're scribes trying to sort it out and reapply it and reappropriate it. That's the end of Blenkinsop and me. This could be said of much of the material in Isaiah 40 to 66. Chapter 58 is a particularly good example. That's where we're going now. For it draws on already existing prophecies, and not only from Isaiah, as a way of demonstrating that the inspired teaching of this school comes out of acknowledged prophetic tradition. They're speaking in opposition now to not those who control the country, that they're over in Persia, but they're talking to their brothers and sisters and the priests in the temple and whoever was round and saying, look, you're getting it wrong, you're getting it wrong, you're forgetting something. And so they're a minority group in opposition, keeping alive the insights from an earlier generation to a people who are getting on with their life, getting on with their business, and with their narrow perspective, pursuing dead ends as they saw it. 58, let's look at it, it's wonderful. Shout out, don't hold back, lift up your voice like a trumpet, announce to my people their rebellion, to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet, now look at this, and this sounds great till we get further on. Day after day they seek me. There they are seeking God at the Wailing Wall or in the mosque or in the St. Peter's Vatican in Rome or in the local parish church. All these, we get 800 people going through our doors every weekend at our little parish, Kipax, and there must be how many more going around. So you've got all this happening. People, what are they doing? They're seeking God. They delight to know my ways. They want to know God's will. Good. As if they were a nation that practiced righteousness and did not forsake the justice of their God. They ask me for righteous judgments. They delight to draw near to God. And this is what they're saying. Why do we fast and you don't see? Why do we humble ourselves, but you don't notice? Brackets. Why did I spend all that money sending my kids to Catholic schools and they seem to know nothing about theology and about the church's teaching? Why did I do all this and then as soon as they get into secondary school, they've left Mass? They're not coming anymore. Do you get me? Yeah. Why are we doing this? Why are we putting money on the plate and the poor are just as poor as ever? And so on. You can have all these thoughts. You've probably got them. So that's what they're wondering. We're doing all this thing. We're seeking God and we're wondering why God isn't responding. Why did I do all this and now I've got cancer? Just when we're just about to retire, or just retired last year. And I've got cancer and my husband's this and that and all our hopes for retirement and we've been saving up and the whole world economy. You can add your own questions because we've all got them. And that's what they're asking. Just how grim conditions were in Judah in the period after the return from exile can be seen from reading the prophecies of Haggai and Zechariah, prophecies, inverted commas, the statements of these two were there among the minor prophets, and they're talking about it. So read it and you can find out for yourselves. It was a pretty grim time, and you can well imagine it, going back to this destroyed city and so on. 70 years later, things were no better. And if you read Nehemiah chapter 5, verse 1 to 5, who describes the breakdown of the system, the country wasn't working well, the poor were poor, nothing was actually happening, because they're a little backwater, for heaven's sake. Economically, they couldn't survive, you could say. So that's how they all are. And they're wondering why God isn't responding. Here's the answer of this group. And they see it as coming from God. You might think it is too. I think it is. Look, he says, you serve your own interests on your fast days. Oh yes, you're fasting, all right. But you're self-centered. You oppress your workers. You're fasting and you're going, and you're not paying them proper wages and you're not caring about the poor and you're taking all the harvest in and you're not leaving any there because you're supposed to leave, you know, reap the harvest, but everything left over is supposed to be left there so people can glean. From the poor can walk through and pick up the rest off the ground. And you're picking it all up. You're picking the blooming tea leaves off the ground and putting them into tea bags and making a fortune out of it. I presume that's what they do. You're oppressing your workmen. Look, you fast and quarrel and you fight and you strike with a wicked fist. That's what you're doing. That's why. Such fasting as you do today will not make your voice heard on high. Is this the fast that I choose? A day to humble yourself, to bow down the head like a bulrush? Wearing purple and putting ashes on yourself and, you know, whatever people might be doing in different cultures. Lying down in sackcloth and ashes? Will you call this a fast? A day acceptable to, here's the point, to Yahweh. Keep your focus. This is Yahweh we're talking about. We're not talking about God, whatever you want to make God. We're talking about Yahweh, the God of history, the God who, with Moses, the God who took us out of Egypt, the God who's not about slaves. But you've got slaves. What are you doing with slaves? And so on. So the criticism is not against fasting any more than it was when Jesus, you remember the scene with Jesus. It's a fast day and Jesus and his disciples aren't fasting. Get it right in because that's extraordinary. Because in these cultures, everybody does it. There are cultures still around today. We're not one of them. And that's good and bad. Mostly good, I think. But some cultures, they're very tightly bound and you better do what everyone else does because you've got no choice. You know what I mean? They're all doing it. Are you with me? And everybody, so it's a fast day. Everybody's fasting. It's a fast day. Jesus is not fasting. I have this picture of the Pope on Good Friday getting ready to give a blessing or something and the TVs are whirring. And then, unexpectedly, the curtain opens too early and the Pope's sitting on the step eating a meat pie. Now, that's my picture of it. And then they say, oh, and the camera's on him. What are you going to do? And he says, oh, look, I don't mean this Pope, I mean just... And he says, I forgot. Forgot it was Good Friday. You're eating a meat pie just before you go out to bless people and we're all fasting. That's the equivalent of what Jesus was doing. Jesus was not fasting on a fast day. And they said to me, what's going on? That's understandable, isn't it? What the heck is going on here? And Jesus says, why would you fast when the bridegroom is with you? He was changing their whole perspective. They were on to about fasting. You've got to fast, you've got to fast. He's saying, no, you've got to love. Nothing wrong with fasting. The time will come for fasting. That's okay, go for it. But for God's sake, remember that this is a love banquet we're on about. We're on about people loving and not about keeping all the people out that can't get in. Do you get me? He's trying to change our perspective, utterly change it, radically change it. Well, these blokes are trying to do it too. The point is that if people are fasting for religious motives, they need to get it into their heads who God is and what's acceptable to Yahweh. And the prophet preachers now go on to spell it out, basing themselves on much of it, on the great Isaiah ben Amos and what he had to say 200 years earlier. Isn't this the kind of fast that I choose? Loose the bonds of injustice. Undo the thongs of the yoke. Let the oppressed go free. Break every yoke. In my juvenile state of mind, which I'm always in, I'm waiting for a bishop one day to put under his escutcheon, break every yoke. Go for it. It would be so hard if you did it, because everyone would be saying, hang on, and good on them. There's a yoke there. Oh, okay, you've got to break it, haven't you? Break every yoke. What a good start that would be to any diocese. If all the bishops did that under their thing, here am I saying I'm not one, of course. Chances are fairly minimal, I would think. But you know what I mean? What a good thing that would be, because all the other nice statements we can all make. But break every yoke is not an easy statement to make. And if someone dared to say it, you'd keep him up to it, wouldn't you? My God, the church would be a very different institution if we started to break every yoke. Then, break every yoke. This is what God wants us to do. Share your bread with the hungry. Bring the homeless poor into your house. When you see the naked, cover them. Don't hide yourself from your own kin. There's a good examination of conscience there. That's not bad. And that's written 2,500 years ago. Then, beautiful, then your light will break forth like the dawn. Then your healing will spring up quickly. Your vindicator shall go before you, and the glory of Yahweh will be behind. You know, as in the desert, the pillar was there in front, the Redeemer, the light, and then at night it would come round and behind them and cover them, so they were protected from before and behind as they walked, marched, scampered through the desert. See the classical text in Exodus 14, 19 to 20. This is as was promised. Yahweh will go before you. The God of Israel will be your rear guard. If you and I lived like that, and that must have been what Mother Therese was thinking when she was stuck in a convent somewhere in Kolkata, or what do they call it these days? And it was a beautiful convent she was in. She was in a beautiful religious order, no complaints or anything, but she had just had to jump over the wall and do something for the poor. That must have been what, don't you think? What drove her to do it? And we're not saying other people should do it. The only thing I can say is I should do it. And if you should do it. And you know what I mean? If we all did it, and we've got some kind of a right to hope that everyone will do it, but that's what the prophet says. He goes on, then you can call and Yahweh will answer. See, they're wondering, why aren't you answering? Why aren't you doing anything when we're fasting? And he says, get on with being a disciple of Yahweh. Then you can call and Yahweh will answer. You can cry for help and he'll say, here I am. So we're belting on the door over here because we think this is the door to eternity and salvation. You know, blah, 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 blah. And God's over there at that door. He said, call then and I'll open the door for you. I'm here with the poor. I'm here with the leper. I'm here with the broken person. I'm here with the person who's in a second marriage and at last has found happiness. But they don't think they can come to communion because they haven't sorted it out. It's too complicated to sort out. You with me? Of course they can come to communion. Of course they come to communion, for God's sake. What would Jesus be doing? He'd be all over them with love, wouldn't he? Well, they're in a third thing and there's this and there's that and they've been hurt this and we've got all these. Then you can call and Yahweh will answer. We're protecting God all the time. We're protecting Jesus from the people in case they He doesn't need protecting. He wants to get out there with them and love them into life. I know that, I'm not trying to be anti, don't you? I'm not trying to be anti-law or anti-order or anti-anything. We've got all these wisdoms around, but the basic wisdom is about people's need for love and need to be welcomed and need to be accepted and need to be embraced. And if we do, they're on a journey to Jesus, to God, to the only God that exists. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, speaking of evil. You get a lot of pious people in every community, I suppose, who are lemons, wrinkled without and bitter within. You do, and picking on everybody around them. I mean, it can be. And
there's a lot of good people out there.
Thank you for saying that, Mary. There are.
And there's a lot of people doing what Mother Teresa's doing. And,
great. Did you think I was saying there weren't?
No, but I do think that should be pointed out.
Thank you, it is, and you've sort of recorded for all time. Because it is, you're dead right. There's much more love in the community than there isn't. So, if you offer your food to the hungry, if you satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light will rise in the darkness and your gloom be like the noonday. Yahweh will guide you continually, satisfy your needs in parched places and make your bones strong. This is lovely, isn't it? You shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. And then he turns attention to the city, which is in a mess. Your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. Well, they're all still a mess. Jerusalem's the city's still in a mess. It took till the middle of the 5th century for the walls to be rebuilt when Nehemiah took over. So prior to that, where these people are writing, then your ancient ruins will be rebuilt. You can build again on foundations laid long ago. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to live in. So that's that quite amazing chapter 58 of Isaiah, which is always relevant. Let's move to 59. Just as the depressed situation in Judah has led to a collapse of confidence in fasting, so it's led to a questioning of the value of prayer. The prophet preachers again stress the need for conversion of heart, and in particular, a commitment to justice. This is the great Isaiah theme. If people are genuinely repentant, their prayer will be heard. The darkness they're experiencing is because they've turned their back on Yahweh. God hasn't turned his back on them. Note the variety of words here used to describe sin, just in this chapter, in these verses. The Hebrew is there, you don't need that, but I'll just read the English. Iniquity, sin, falsity, perversity, worthlessness, fraud, mischief, evil, violence, and another word for evil. So these prophets are pretty determined anyhow, and they're not negative prophets, but they're pointing out, they're not there to point out all the good things. Everyone's pretty aware of them. They're there to say, come on, get real. So let's see what they say. Chapter 59, verses 1 to 4. See, Yahweh's arm is not so short that he cannot save. Yahweh isn't the problem. Nor is his ear so dull that he can't hear. Rather, your iniquities have been barriers between you and your God. Your sins have hidden his face from you so that he doesn't hear. For your hands are defiled with blood, your fingers with iniquity. So we're talking about their actions. Your lips have uttered what is false. Your tongue mutters what is perverse. No one brings suit to court justly. No one goes to law honestly. Now, I presume he's exaggerating. There probably were one or two that did it. But, it is, on the whole, it's how they're seeing their community. They rely on worthless and fraudulent arguments, conceiving mischief and begetting iniquity. I'll just skip a couple of verses because I can't read the whole thing with you. Verse 7. Their feet run to evil. They rush to shed innocent blood. Their thoughts are thoughts of iniquity. Desolation and destruction are in their paths. The way of peace they don't know, and there's no justice in their paths. That's quoted by Romans chapter 3 by Paul. So he was full of this stuff too, and every now and then it burst out of his letters. There's a quote. Their roads they've made crooked. No one walks in them, knows peace. Therefore justice is far from us, and righteousness doesn't reach us. He must have lived in a pretty desperate time, but what's the Chinese proverb? But interesting to that. We wait for light and there's darkness. We wait for brightness, but we're walking in gloom. We grope like blind along a wall, groping like those who have no eyes. We stumble at noon as though it were twilight, and among the vigorous as though we were dead. Now, this may not apply to us and to our generation. It may. You have to work that out, and I have to work that out. But it certainly applied to his, obviously, or at least they thought it was. Justice is turned back and righteousness stands at a distance. For truth, what a line, truth stumbles in the public square. I would underline that if I were you. Make sure you don't lose that 59:14. Politics, I mean, just that's the obvious thing. Church politics as well. I mean, truth stumbles in the public square, in the public arena, the media world. How much truth, you know? I'm not knocking it all by any means. I'm just saying when truth stumbles in the public square, it infects a lot of us because the air you breathe in is the air others are breathing out. Uprightness cannot enter. Truth is lacking. Truth is when what you say is in accordance with the way things really are, not in accordance with the way you want people to hear it so that they will approve or support, or in the next poll you'll be so many percent ahead. Do you know what I mean? But we're all in danger of speaking to appear. We don't want that. You don't want it. I don't want it. We're not about that. We have to say it as it is, not bluntly, lovingly, yes. But truth is critical. Without truth, there's no love. So truth is lacking, and whoever turns from evil is despoiled. If you try to be truthful in their situation, perhaps in ours, then you get put aside. Yahweh saw it, and it displeased him that there was no justice. He saw and was appalled that there was no one to intervene. He's inspiring people to intervene, but they're gutless or they're tired or they're whatever, and they're not bothering. So his own arm brought him victory. His righteousness upheld him. He put on righteousness like a breastplate, and a helmet of salvation on his head, and he put on garments of vengeance, vindication, vengeance, attacking the rich so that the poor will survive, attacking the unjust so that God's doing this. And he wrapped himself in fury as a mantle. That's their image of God, coming in to determine that the poor will not remain the way they are. And Paul uses that imagery in Ephesians 6, chapter 7, 14 and 17. Stand therefore, fasten the belt of truth round your waist, put on the breastplate of righteousness, take the helmet of salvation, the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. Remember who said it? Jesus, did he? The gates of hell, yeah. I mean, put on Jesus' lips anyhow. The gates of hell will not prevail against the church. So the church is actually on the attack. Gates, you know what gates are for? To protect a city from a besieging army? You put a ram into them? Well, the church isn't there protecting itself against the world as though we've got this fragile little thing. The church is supposed to be right out in front, at the very forefront of breaking yokes. At the very forefront. We could be forgiven for thinking that as a group of people we're actually not at the forefront. We're holding back a bit, you can include yourself in the we if you want to, but the church isn't noted for being right out in front in matters of justice, I think. Well, when I was at the university, just every group I was in, they were all ex-Catholics. So they learned something at school from the Christian Brothers. You know, they got it into their system, but they didn't find it in the church, so they'd left the church, but they were still there at the front of the, on the barricades. Ex-Catholics. Well, they were, you know, do you know what I'm trying to say? Something. Whereas the church as an institution should be there ramming the doors, not building thicker gates to protect itself. 59:21. As for me, me is the prophet, this is my covenant. I'm sorry, this is Yahweh. This is my covenant with them. My spirit that is upon you, you, the Isaiah group, my spirit that is upon you, my words that I put in your mouth, inspiration, shall not depart out of your mouth or out of the mouths of your children or out of the mouths of your children's children from now on or forever. What you are, what we, this little group, the Isaiah group, what God is inspiring them is going to be there for them forever, because the message has to stay alive. Chapters 56 to 59 conclude with the servants of the school staking their claim to have been given the spirit of prophecy. This is the spirit given to Moses. Moses was succeeded by Joshua. In exile, the Isaiah school inherited this prophetic spirit. Read 55 verse 1. And now their children are carrying on this tradition.